Good afternoon, everybody. If I start sneezing, it's because I've gotten hay fever. You know, I never got hay fever before this summer. I had get kind of hot making hay and when I was a kid, but that's not hay fever. Well, there's some extra pollen in the air, apparently, and there's something in our backyard that doesn't agree with me very much on that regard, but now I feel for those who do get hay fever all the time, and for no particularly good reason either. Anyway, I did make a correction regarding announcements. First and third, it's 1 o'clock in Youngstown, because I'm over on the other side of the circuit, and second and fourth Sabbaths, when I have to come, you know, I'm do Youngstown and North Canton, that's when they have an 11 o'clock service. And that's where we had it this morning. We have Youngstown churches coming along very well. I think you probably have read in the announcements what I put in the little note in the beginning. We've had a surge of attendance last week in Wheeling and in Pittsburgh. I got a call from a lady in West Virginia late last week, and she explained that her extended family date back from when her mother was baptized in the Radio Church of God. Now, you put your thinking caps on, that has to be at least 1968, because that's when they changed over to Worldwide in the organizational name. I said, well, how many are coming? Because it was a group, and she said, well, I think 15. Turned out only to be 13. But then we found out, or Jim Coher found out from her later, that there may be as many as 23 who are down in that part of West Virginia. They used to attend one of the congregations at Worldwide in the past. And so we're very happy to have them with us. We had a delightful visit with everybody after services in Wheeling and made us late getting to Pittsburgh, but that's just part of the territory. Hopefully this week I'll be able to go down to where they are in West Virginia and get acquainted a little bit more. But that was just right out of the blue. And what wasn't out of the blue, because they sent a letter ahead of time, is the Church of God International congregation in the Pittsburgh area, which was mostly made up of former UCG members. They'd gotten so small, and their pastor, who had heart problems and his wife has cancer that she's battling right now, so they all decided it would be wise to just dissolve the congregation and go back to United, and called us and, you know, let us know about it, and would it be all right? And of course it would be all right. And so we had nine of them in Pittsburgh last Sabbath. And that's not all. There were several more that weren't able to come. They were traveling that day. So we're seeing some exciting developments along those lines, and we just need to pray that God will continue to bless us with, you know, some positive growth. Youngstown, as I also mentioned, we've outgrown the hall. If any of you have been up to visit Youngstown, generally you should check ahead. If they're going to have everybody there, it is just about to the point where it's standing room only. All the chairs are taken up, and you have to be all kind of squeezed together. It's been a nice little location right off the freeway there at the Hampton Inn, but their meeting room is just a little smaller than what we need now. So they're on the hunt. They've got two or three that they want to look at, and we'll get one of those picked out here before long. So there will be room when you do want to go up and visit Youngstown sometime. There'll be some place for you to sit, which is always nice. Although I don't find myself sitting during the whole service myself, so I get to stand up and talk, which is what I'm supposed to do now. America Needs the Truth. There's your title. And it's a title, I think, that echoes. We watch what has happened as far as the common sense level in the American parlance and the American discussions. We don't have wisdom and sense anymore. We used to. We used to have quite a bit of it in a lot of areas. Now, you know, we weren't without, you know, failures and faults of it, but we had a lot of it. But that has disappeared over the past 15 years or so, and most notably because of the political tug-of-war that's been taking place, and we we aren't invested in the politics of the nation. Our politics are in the kingdom of God. And, you know, if you want a trump card, that's the trump card. And not President Trump, although he, you know, is surely takes on the liberal media pretty dramatically. And they've needed it. The media has decided it's a force unto itself. You know, an outgrowth of our university systems and the line of thinking that we can thank Karl and Charles for. Karl Marx and Charles Darwin. Back in the 1800s, Communist Manifesto was written in 1840 or approximately there. And The Origin of Species, which was the introduction to the theory of evolution by Charles Darwin, was printed in 1860. And those were two huge, ignition systems that launched a lot of terrible thinking. It didn't really catch on until the 20th century, but look back over the 20th century and you see the fruits of that line of thinking. And you wonder, well, where's it gone now? You know, the communists found out that that doesn't work, especially the Russians, and the Chinese. And, you know, what about evolution? Where have all the proponents of that gone? And the answer is they've gone into the news media and the university systems. That's what maintains that momentum. You know, they don't want to think that there's a God. And so America is blinded. And it's not just America. You know, we could say the same thing about Britain and about any nation in the world. But when we come around the 4th of July, the anniversary of America as a nation, and since we live here and have to deal with this here, I think it's important that we reaffirm that, yes, America needs the truth. And I don't mean just truth in a general sort of sense, but the truth, beyond just being truthful. Years ago, my grandmother came into the church. I mean, many years ago. It was 1953 in Portland, Oregon. And her standard line, which in fact was similar to most of the brethren at that time, for introducing yourself to some church member you hadn't met yet, whether in the local congregation, and they had 300 plus there in Portland at that time, or when you went to the feast and you get to visiting with people, fellowshipping after services. Her leading question was, when did you come to the knowledge of the truth? Code word, when did God start to call you, you know, the knowledge of the truth? And then the discussion, everybody would, you know, they'd share their stories back and forth. And you really got to know each other rapidly from that perspective, because there was a lot of commonality among God's people as they were coming out of the world, starting to understand God's truth, and making the changes in their life, which was part of the process of repentance. America needs to repent, but it really, really needs the truth. It needs the truth, I think, in four areas, and I'll get to those, but you might ask, you know, we have had a significant measure of the truth as the world would view it within America. That's what made it strong as a nation, didn't it? And it did. We did it. We had a principle generally of honesty in the United States. And it predominated over the liars, cheaters, stealers, and two-timers and the double dealers. It predominated over them. They were not able to steer the culture. And if they did, for a while in a local area, then along came Jones and straightened it out, you know, the sheriff or whoever it happened to be, some great hero. We have a lot of grand stories about that. But we can look back and we can see where America has understood much intuitively of God's way, primarily because the founding fathers recognized the value of God's word. How many King James Bibles did we bring today? Anybody? Oh, we got a, whoa, Youngstown is so far behind the times. I got to tell them that. None of them had a King James Bible. We have probably half of them here. That was printed in 16, not your copy, of course, but it was printed in 1636. The project of the translating from the Hebrew and the Greek was overseen and sponsored by King James of England, King James I of England. He was King James VI of Scotland. Thank you. resident scholar had just corrected me before I got sixth all the way out. But King James did the world a great favor, the English-speaking world. In fact, it consolidated the English language because we used it, that is the textbook in England to a great extent. But as the colonies began to be populated in 1636, you know that the colonies were already in existence. Massachusetts had been in existence for a decade or two, and a couple of others over here. But more and more immigrants wanted to go to America. It was a land of opportunity. There was a freedom to do things, to get out from under, they thought, the king. There was a little discussion about that in the late, say, the 1700s that had to be settled. But if they could afford one book, it's expensive to immigrate. Normally, you got sent over because you misbehaved in some way, and so you were sent to the colonies as punishment. And you're normally sold into indentured servitude for, you know, 7 years or 14 years or something like that. That was not uncommon. We have the wife of one of the pastors in Australia, a dear friend of ours for a long time in the ministry. She and her husband. Her great, I don't know, about three greats, grand or four greats, grandmother was one of those sent to the penal colony of Australia for 7 years because she kept the Sabbath. And the Anglican Church didn't like Sabbath keepers. So she never left. She went to Australia and stayed there. And there was more freedom in Australia than there had been in England, and there was more freedom in America than there had been in England. So we have had an opportunity, but that King James Bible was a critical part of it. If you could afford one book, that's what you would bring. You'd bring the Bible. Because Britain was, as we call it in the world, a Christian nation, so was America to be. If once you got here, you know, schools were few and far between for the early pioneers, so you had to learn to read something, and you learned to read the Bible. And that tradition carried on for many years. My grandmother, the one I told you about that said, "When did you come to the knowledge of the truth?" When she was a little girl, she read to her grandmother. And her grandmother, and I don't know if I've told the story here before, but it was her grandmother or her grandmother's daughter, I forget exactly, or her grandmother's mother. It was at the end of the Civil War, and they lived in the Missouri area along the borderline between North, where it had been between North and South, and raiders, like Quantrell's raiders, the James brothers rode with Quantrell in the war, and then they had their own raiders that they rode and ransacked and attacked people and robbed and, you know, all those bad things that they shouldn't have been doing, but they did it. So the father of the family was in town getting supplies, and Mom and the two girls were at home, and they looked out across the plains, and here came riders. That was not a good sign, because they were beelining straight at their property and galloping at, you know, a significant rate of speed. They were going to be there. So the mother gathered the two girls, and they got down and they prayed for God's protection and intervention. And suddenly they started hearing hoofbeats running round and around their house on their little farm. And they looked out their little window, and here was a different troop, different colored uniforms and everything, galloping around the house. But in the distance, the other riders had stopped. And they were watching what was going on, and pretty soon they spun their ponies around and they took off just as fast as they'd come. And as soon as they disappeared over the horizon, the horses galloping around the house vaporized. Poof, they were gone. You know, a little divine intervention is what it was. From what we've been able to gather of that grandmother, great-great-great-great-great-grandmother and the daughters, they knew of the Sabbath, and it seems to have been in the knowledge in the family for a long time. So one of those daughters, if I remember correctly, was my grandmother's grandmother. And when Grandma Alice, my mother, grandma, was little, she could read well. And so great-grandmother's eyes were getting bad. So she would have to read the Bible to her in the evening. And as soon as her grandma seemed to nod off, then she would skip ahead a few verses, maybe a page, and start to read there. And grandmother would open her eyes and say, "Alice, you skipped some. And what you skipped is," and then she would start quoting the scriptures that she had skipped over. And then she would make Alice commence after that. So the knowledge of the scriptures was highly valued in America. It was our educational textbook in the earliest years. And what that did is it pinned the values of the Ten Commandments and the summaries of God's Word and the richness of the language of God's Word. It just pinned it all over the American culture for the good. That was a positive thing. The Ten Commandments by the Founding Fathers was considered to be the best word on the instruction of lawmaking. And that's part of the reason, and that not just the Founding Fathers, but others that came after them, and that's why it got carved into the Supreme Court building. And it was carved on all the other state houses around the atheistic thinking liberal media and others have complained about and gotten removed. Now, that's not it's not a healthy thing for America when it loses God's truth, but it has. Charles Darwin's theory of evolution has so permeated the core thinking of the educational system that is the basis. There is no God is the premise you start with. But if you do, you're starting with a bad premise. Ask the communists. That was the premise of communism. You go back and read how communist governments treated their people. They didn't treat them well. There have been researchers who analyze how many purge killings were done by various governments down through history. And in the modern history, the communist governments, especially Russia and China, have been the worst. And you can say, well, what about Nazism? Well, it would have been worse than them, except that Hitler got stopped. He killed faster. They killed longer simply because they lasted longer than him. Soviet Union is credited by various historians with having purged 70 million people in their 70 years of existence. These are not capital punishment for crime, and they're not war deaths, battle deaths at all. These are exterminating people. You know, mass hits on cultures. Stalin starving the white Russians to death by taking their grain in the 30s and other times. So you have, when you don't have a conscience, a government doesn't have an underpinning of some truth, and it doesn't have a conscience. America had a lot of the principles of God's truth, and you think, well, how could they forget it? You know, how could our nation forget those elements of the truth they did have? Well, let me give you an example of how another nation forgot the truth. And you, this nation read the Bible all the time. They could quote you the entire Old Testament. The really good ones were really knowledgeable teachers of their groups. It's in John chapter 8. But they forgot truth. And it's almost comical how badly they had forgotten some very basic things which are actually in the Scriptures. We want to go to John chapter 8. Christ is there explaining his teaching and who he is. As you go down through, say, verse 13 on, he talks about his departure as well. You know, in other words, his death and resurrection and so on. And as he, in verse 28, Jesus said to them, "When you lift up the Son of Man," that's going to be the crucifixion being lifted up, "then you will know that I am He, and that I do nothing of myself, but as my Father taught me, I speak these things, and He who sent me is with me. And the Father has not left me alone, for I always do those things that please Him." And he spoke these words. As he spoke these words, many believed him. So we have a group who were believing, but if you go back and you read the earlier exchange where the other red letters are in the other column on that chapter, you will find that the Jews who were responding there were not believing in him. They were arguing with him. They were opposing him. So now we come to verse 31. "And then Jesus said to the Jews who believed him, 'If you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.'" Then the response is not the response of the Jews who believed him, But the response, the in-character response of the other Jews that were arguing with him, they answered him, and they said, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. So how can you say you will be made free?" In other words, we are free people. We've never been in bondage to anyone. Really? What did they forget? How about Nebuchadnezzar? The Jews were taken captive by the Babylonians, Nebuchadnezzar being the leader of it at the time. The Babylonian Empire conquered them. The northern kingdom of Israel, the ten tribes, they were conquered by the Assyrians in 720 B.C. And it was in 586 B.C. that Jerusalem was burned and sacked, and the Jews were all taken captive. That was the final battle of the conquest of the Babylonians to take over Judea. And then they were the slaves of the Babylonians. We have never been in bondage to anyone. These people were in serious denial. And they might say, well, you know, that was that little problem there with the Babylonians. But after that, no, we weren't. Well, just a minute. The Babylonians were conquered by the Persians. That would have been about 538 B.C. Not that long after. And then the Jews had to answer to the Persians. Now, they were nicer for the most part, except for that Haman guy. He wasn't so nice. But the Persians were tended to be a little fairer with them, and they let some of the Jews go back and rebuild the temple and so on. But they still answered to the Persian emperor. And then what happened to that Persian, the last Persian emperor? It's all Greek to me, and it was all Greek to him, wasn't it? Alexander came riding across the plains and destroyed the Persian Empire and made a Greek empire, Greco-Macedonian, technically. Well, I give the Macedonians a little credit, since Alexander was one. And so then the Greeks ruled the Jews. And if you go back and read that history, it wasn't a very good history. Occasionally it was reasonably benign, but that's the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, setting up the abomination of desolation. Offering a pig on the altar of burnt offerings and putting a statue of Jupiter in the temple itself. You know, he was insulting the religion of the Jews, and which was the true religion at the time. And that was he was one bad guy. In fact, there were a number of bad Greeks. And then they had two Greek empires to deal with, the one in the south that ruled Egypt. One of Alexander's, when Alexander died, one of his generals took over Egypt, and another general stayed in Syria. And the Syrian one became the king of the north, and the one in Egypt was the king of the south, and Judea was a tug-of-war in between the two, because the Greeks didn't get along with each other. So they beat up on the Jews in the middle. And the Jews were in bondage from two directions. Well, that got better, because the Greeks got a good old knockout blow along about 63 B.C. by the Romans. And then they were ruled by the Romans. So you go back and you read this, and he said, "The truth will make you free." And then they said, "We are Abraham's descendants, and I've never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say we will be made free?" You see, the basic historical truths that, poof, were gone from their consciousness. And that's happening in America. If you listen carefully, every so often you'll hear a poof. Yep, there went some more knowledge. There went some more common sense. Yeah, it's a sad thing to watch. You know, we're living in it, and we know the prophecies. We expected this, but it's sad to see it happen. You know, we love our country, and we should love our country. We love God more, of course, but we love our country all the same. There are four key truths that America so desperately needs. Let's look at those four truths. The first one is this: they need the truth of God's existence. That's the foundational one. America needs the truth of God's existence. Let's turn back to a psalm, Psalm 53. If you turn to Psalm 14, don't worry, you can read Psalm 14 just as well, because the only difference between the two psalms are about four or five words. Psalm 53. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Oh, now I understand my country so much better. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. I mean, when you look, go back there to what we read in John chapter 8, Christ was conversing with some of the fools of Judea at the time. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable iniquity. There is none who does good. Now, this is a blanket statement that applies to mankind throughout history generally, with the few exceptions that God had himself called. God looks down from heaven upon the children of man to see if there are any who understand, who seek God. Every one of them is turned aside. They have together become corrupt. Together become corrupt. They aided and abetted each other. They fostered a culture of corruptness, denying God's existence, or denying, if he existed, denying his power, or whatever it was. What we have are the fools of fools who deny his existence in spite of all the massive evidence that disproves their premise. And they are vehement in their denial of God's existence by championing the theory of evolution. To them, it's fact, when it isn't fact at all. Every one of them is turned aside. They have together become corrupt. There is none who does good, no, not one. Have the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread, and do not call upon God? And that's what happens. You end up with a culture that doesn't have a conscience that is guided at least by some of the vital principles of God's thinking and God's way. And so they eat up the people. They have no conscience. And you look at the communist, the evolutionary communists, like the Soviet Union, using that as a key one, but the others were like that too. We could talk about the killing fields of Cambodia in the late 70s. That was awful. Cambodia only had 6 million people. Under the Khmer Rouge communist government, which was communist like the other communists, there is no God, they exterminated one-third of their population. That was the killing fields of Cambodia, a nation killing one-third of its own people. Very sad. Who eat up my people as they eat bread, who do not call upon God. And they are in great fear where no fear was, for God has scattered the bones of him who encamps against you, and you have put them to shame because God has despised them. They have nothing to fall back upon. Those who at least understood that God existed, if they did not know all his teachings and doctrines correctly, they at least knew he existed, and they could look to an eternal God that was benevolent and loving. When things turn badly for the atheist thinkers, they have no recourse. They have no fallback. There's nothing that they can hope for. Right now, they don't think about that. And that's because of arrogance. But they will think about it eventually. You have put them to shame because God has despised them, and he will put them to shame. Oh, that the salvation of Israel would come out of Zion when God brings back the captivity of his people, and let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad. Won't that be a great time? And we look forward to that on the grandest scale of all when Christ returns. Let's go to Romans chapter 3 as we talk about this culture, or this the truth of God's existence is what America needs. First and foremost, it needs that. It all starts with that. Romans chapter 3. First, let's read verse 12 of Romans 3. Just make sure I've got my notation correct here. No, let's not. Let's just read this whole section. Starts in verse 9. We'll give a little context. What then? Paul is asking the church at Rome. Are we better than they? You know, he's answering that in the Jews better than the Gentiles, essentially, is what this question is. Not at all. Not at all. For we have previously charged both Jews and Greeks, And Greeks was often used as a term in the New Testament to simply mean the Gentiles, because the bulk of the ones that the apostles dealt with that were Gentiles were Greeks. And Greek was the language of education for the most part in the Roman Empire. Roman families in Rome would buy a slave called a pedagogos from Greece to come and teach their children, private instructor, as a slave. That was the way the Romans ran things. Not good. Are we better than they? Not at all. We have previously charged both Jews and Greeks that they are all under sin. Jews sin as much as the Greeks sin. People are people. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks after God. They have all turned aside. They have together become unprofitable. There is none who does good, no, not one. That sounds familiar. We just read it back in the Psalms. Their throat is an open tomb. With their tongues they have practiced deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips. An asp, by the way, is a poisonous snake. Have you ever had a poisonous snake strike at you? I don't think I have. I've had a non-poisonous snake strike at me, but I thought it was poisonous at the time. I was 8 years old and doing a standing broad jump I could never do again and jump that far till I was in my late teens. From a standing, just standing still and jumping straight forward. And as I'm jumping, I'm looking over my shoulder and the mouth of this big snake, it was over 5 feet long, had its mouth wide open, reaching for the calf of my leg. And I'm watching this all in slow motion as I'm launching forward and landed on my feet. Unfortunately for the snake, I was carrying a BB gun. I thought I'd killed my first rattlesnake. It turned out to be a bull snake, and bull snakes were our friends. Well, then why did it try to bite me? So they ate rattlesnakes for breakfast. That's what my dad told me, and sometimes for supper, too, if they were still hungry. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. That's the culture America is headed for. In fact, it is already mostly there. It's just a striking and sad circumstance that we are facing that. And what kind of a culture does that engender? What does that turn the nation into? A nation that so desperately needs that truth? Let's go back to chapter 1. Romans chapter 1, starting in verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness. All ungodliness. You know, there isn't any sin. You know, we look at it personally, you know, as we think about our relationship with Christ and the Father. There isn't any personal sin that God doesn't really mind about. Now, God does not like any ungodliness. That's another way of saying sin is ungodliness. And unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Well, it is our purpose in God's church, and has been whenever it has actually been God's church, and not just a group, a religious group that had the wrong name, has been to express and promote and spread the truth in righteousness. But those who suppress it in unrighteousness, that's not good. That's happening in our society. It's happened in the church, too, when we have historical memories of it. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. And we can think, well, who are some of the they? Well, how about the scientific community to start with? They are the ones that are intimately aware of the laws of science. I'm not sure that Darwin was a scientist. But if he was, he must have understood at least the first law of biogenesis. Life begets life. Therefore, the theory of evolution is for the birds. It's not true. But he must have forgot that. And look at the havoc what he wrote has wreaked. Or wrought, or wrecked, whichever word we want to use, since then. For since the creation of his world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen. The creation proves the creator, essentially, is what that's saying. being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. So they are without excuse, because although they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. As they began to take communism, you know, from the socialistic point of view, as it's social Darwinism is another term for communism, that's what Karl Marx was promoting, and then lock into it the scientific basis or scientific principle of the theory of evolution, which is completely false, just as false as what Marx said is what Darwin said. You lock those two together, and they become futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened in the modern era. There must have been something similar back in the day for others that were rejecting God. Mostly they rejected God by replacing God with pagan gods. And that's a whole other story, but a very similar principle. Verse 22, professing to be wise, they became fools, and they changed the glory of God into the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. So this is what paganism did. Instead of looking to the great God that made everything, they want to make gods that they make and that they can bow down to and that they can worship because they made those gods. Mainly they wanted in those days to make gods that gave them excuse for wild drunken parties and adultery. It was the sex. That's what really sold paganism in those days. The temple sex. The prostitution houses of the world were the temples of the pagan gods and goddesses. And you can begin to understand why it was a terrible pull that people had to fight against, even in the church. It was a horrible evil. But now today we have that in just infused throughout the general culture, unfortunately. But we have the new paganism of elevating the creation far above the creator, which, you know, we don't call it a creation, it's the evolution. Therefore God, verse 24, gave them up to uncleanness and the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie. They rejected the truth. America has begun more vehemently than it has ever has begun to reject the basic truth of God's existence. And worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to vile passions. This is all the expected behaviors. Even their women exchanged the natural use for what was against nature. Likewise, the men have, leaving the natural use of the woman, burdened their lust for one another, men with men, committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error, which is due. And that kind of lifestyle led to another step away from God. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. And when we say not fitting, you've got to understand that are not righteous. That's what fitting means. They don't fit into God's way because they are sins. Being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, and when I rattle through this, you have to admire Paul's ability to compose lists. There are lists that have bullwhip cracks mixed into them. Being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful. I like the un section particularly. Who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. This is our culture. This is America. This is why America needs the truth that God exists. Because when a society rejects the existence of God on a significant enough scale, then this is what it turns into. And what I just read, you can see around you right now. That's all here. We could see the harbingers of it a few decades ago, but it's all here now. And it's all bad. It's a frightful thing. It's essentially a societal meltdown that we're in the process of watching. And yet, if they knew that God existed, Even that much would change a great deal of the culture around us. They don't seem to be interested. We just have to make sure that we stay very strong and we keep the fact that the truth that God does exist clearly in our minds and pray that God will spread it to others, you know, that he's calling. Let's go to the second truth, the truth of divine law. You think, well, America's got laws. Yeah, but they're not based on divine law. Much of America's jurisprudence has been based on the Ten Commandments. You know, love your neighbor as yourself. Be fair. And there is a God who exists, so beware. Be fair and beware. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 18. Talks about divine law, the value of divine law. This is another great truth America has gotten rid of. And you wonder why? Because the law of God, the Ten Commandments, has been carved into so many of our federal and state institutions, into the buildings. Where says this one crazy man that keeps trying to use his truck to run over one sign that has the Ten Commandments on it. This was in the news here recently. And they keep putting it up, and he keeps running it over. So they, hopefully they'll come to some resolution of that before long. Why does he keep running over the Ten Commandments? Chances are it's because he hates it. He doesn't believe in God. He has taken his education in university seriously. Never do that. Now, you've got to take, if you go to university, for our young people, you carry a pound of salt with you. Sprinkle it liberally through your textbooks. Then read them. I'm being facetious, but it's illustrating the point. Take it with a grain of salt. Take it with a pound of salt. Because you've got to sort a lot of junk to find what is actually valuable. Where were we? Oh, yes, chapter 18 of Leviticus, verses 1 to 5. And Deuteronomy won't do it. It has to be Leviticus. Excuse me just a second. Talk and read, and I can read the number, but I didn't read the book I was in. All right, here we are. The Eternal said to Aaron, you and your sons, and your father is his numbers. Sorry. Leviticus chapter 18. Now we're correct. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, I am the Eternal your God. According to the doings of the land of Egypt, where you dwelt, you shall not do. I am God. See, the premise is God exists. Then the second thing is, you will not do what the Egyptians did. But I love the way that it's phrased. According to the doings of the Egyptians, you shall not do. Well, what were the doings of the Egyptians? Primarily, it was paganism, Egyptian paganism. It wasn't as attractive. I don't know, maybe the Egyptians liked it. They had human bodies on most of their gods and goddesses, and then some kind of an animal or a fish or a bird head. You know, so some of their gods were bird-brained, and some were wolf-brained, and some were fish-brained. I guess that was just the thing that the Egyptians liked to have. In Greek and Rome, or Greece and Rome rather, they actually had mostly human forms representing their gods and goddesses. I don't think they liked the strange masks that the Egyptians liked to put on theirs, but that's what it was. And they worshiped those gods and goddesses in the same basic way. Adultery and all kinds of other debauchery. So according to the doings of the land of Egypt, you shall not do. And according to the doings of the land of Canaan, where I am bringing you, you shall not do. Do not copy the doings of the pagan society around you, nor shall you walk in their ordinances. In other words, their laws are shaped by their perverted religion and philosophies. You shall observe my judgments and keep my ordinances. In other words, you will keep my law. Ordinances and judgments are words for law, to walk in them. I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and judgments, which, get the last line out of verse 5, which if a man does, or I think the King James is, which if a man do, then he shall live by them. I am the Eternal. God's way is the way of life, a way you can live by. Let's go to Romans chapter 7 now. Romans chapter 7. And I am concentrating on the name of the book as I make my turn. Here we are. What is God's law like? We have an initial definition in verse 14 of Romans 7. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal. Carnal means physical. I am physical, sold under sin. That's what Paul wrote. Now, Paul had done a lot of overcoming, but he knew that humanly, that's what he was. And whatever value he had was based on God's active working in his life and his spirit, God's spirit in his mind. And then we drop back from verse 14 back to verse 7. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Well, we have the sort of religious sounding evolutionarily influenced people who would say that the law is sin, when in fact sin is the transgression of the law. But this, what Paul was addressing, was the kind of heresy that probably was very much in extent in Rome at that time, and maybe seeping into the church from time to time. It had to be rooted out. Certainly not, he says, on the contrary. I would have not known sin except through the law. That's why we know what sin is, because the law identifies it. For I would not have known covetousness unless the law said, you shall not covet. But sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil desire. I'm not sure what Paul would have coveted. Maybe better sewing needles for his sail-making business. He was a tent maker and a sail maker, you know, as far as a trade went. And he sometimes did that in the process of establishing a congregation someplace. So the sin sort of has this, is personified here. Sin taking opportunity by the commandment produced in me all manner of evil desire. For apart from sin, the law was dead. if I didn't know the law, I didn't know I was sinning. I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. And the commandment, which was to bring life, I found to bring death. For sin, by taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me and by it killed me. So that's a personification. It's a literary technique he was using in the previous verses. He comes then to the summary in verse 12. Therefore, the law, meaning the law of God, the law is holy and the commandment holy and just and good. America needs the truth of God's law so desperately. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy chapter 8, getting at verse 1. Every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land the Lord has sworn to your fathers. And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and to test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not, whether you saw the value of divine law. And verse 3, so he humbled you, and he allowed you to hunger. And then he fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know. Manna was an unprecedented miracle. Nothing, no other miracle like that had ever been done. That he might make you that to know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. Well, that last part gets quoted in the New Testament, doesn't it? But he made Israel eat manna so that they would know that man doesn't live by bread alone. In the ancient world, and not even that ancient world, one of the main sources of calories in people's diets was bread. Except for Asia, maybe, they had a lot of rice. It's hard to make bread out of rice. But in the other parts of the world, it was bread. The Israelites were used to having bread baked. And then they started eating manna, which was in place of bread. So they learned that they didn't live by bread alone. For 40 years, they lived by something other than bread. They lived by manna. Likewise, we live by God's word, by God's law. Let's turn over to Isaiah chapter 51. Isaiah 51. We want to look at verse 7 in Isaiah 51. It's a challenge. God is speaking through the prophet. He says, listen to me, you who know righteousness, you people in whose heart is my law. Do not fear the reproach of men, nor be afraid of their insults. For the moth will eat them. Will eat them up like a garment, and the worm will eat them up like wool. But my righteousness will be forever, and my salvation from generation to generation. Listen to me, you who know righteousness. We would come into that. We know what righteousness is. God's opened our minds to that. That's why we're here today on the Sabbath day, to learn more about it. Listen to me, you who know righteousness, you people in whose heart is my law. America needs God's divine law, but it isn't in America's heart right now. There's not even a semblance of it in America's heart. And that's the tragedy, and we're seeing the effects of that right before our eyes as the societal evolution takes place. As one of the commentators uses that term. It's more of a devolution, though. It's not evolving up, it's devolving down, and it's going down rapidly. Let's turn to Jeremiah 31. When will the law of God be in the hearts of all Americans? There is a time, and we need to remind ourselves of that. There will be a time when it will all change, and God's law will be in their hearts, even as it is to be in our hearts right now. And that is through the power of God's Spirit, of course. Jeremiah 31, Ezekiel won't do. There is a time, and here it is, in verse 31. Behold, the days are coming, says the Eternal, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, though I was a husband to them, says the Lord. God held up his part of the bargain, but they didn't. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel in those days. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. They will internalize my law, which defines my way of living. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And no more shall every man teach his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they will all know me. From the least of them to the greatest of them, says the Eternal, and I will forgive their iniquity and their sin I will remember no more. This is the New Covenant passage. That whole section we just read, you'll find quoted word for word in Hebrews 8. That's the longest quotation from the Old Testament you'll find in the New Testament, is the New Covenant. But there will be a time when divine law will be in the hearts and minds of those who live in America. The time is coming. And we know it's when it is. It's going to be for the nation as a whole. It's going to be when Christ returns during the millennium and thereafter. But right now, it isn't there. America desperately needs the truth of God's divine law. It also needs the truth of its America's historical tribal origin. It needs to know who it is historically. America doesn't understand that. We do, but we need to keep sharp in our understanding of it. Because this is ridiculed. If it comes from the Bible, it gets ridiculed. And even our young people have to battle this tremendously. When they're going through the university system, it will pollute your thinking processes if you take your professor seriously. Except for those rare ones. And there are a few. Search them out and learn from them. But most of them go with the party line. Evolution is true. There is no God. The communists had it right. That's the party line. And they don't want to be different. It's peer pressure. They're like a bunch of little teenagers that are worried about being rejected by their friends. You know, more or less is what it amounts to. Did I tell us where we were going? Genesis 48. What we're going to do is we're going to read about Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, we know, we just need to have the proofs clarified and reviewed from time to time. We know that America is descended from the Israelite tribe of Manasseh, but we need to know where Manasseh came from because He wasn't one of the sons of Jacob. He was a grandson of Jacob. And this is the story behind it. It starts in verse 8 of Genesis 48. Here we go. Then Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, "Who are these?" Now, try to give you a setting here. Joseph, of course, got shanghaied by his brothers into Egypt. And so he ended up in Egypt, and before long, you know, after a few years of being in prison, he got elevated to being the prime minister of the country in charge of preparing for the coming famine, empowered by the Pharaoh himself. Number two in the land was Joseph. So then Joseph decided he needed to have his family come down, but his brothers needed a little humbling. And there was a little exchange of sticking the gold cup in the bag of grain a couple times that sufficiently unnerved his brothers to where they were in a teachable mood. If you remember the story, and go back and read it again sometime if you haven't. Then he had the whole family move to Egypt. And when Pharaoh found out about it, he was overjoyed. They get the best of the land, and they landed in Goshen. Goshen was the Nile Delta. That's where the water provided the grassland that you didn't have in the deserts around Egypt. And they were livestock keepers, the Israelites were, so they needed to be based there. And they lived well in Egypt for 150 years approximately, and then they were slaves for as long as America's been a nation, before they were finally freed with the Exodus. So we're still at the beginning of all this. They've just gotten there, and so Joseph wants to bring his two sons that were born to him in Egypt to his father so he can bless them. And when Israel, or Jacob, saw Joseph's son in verse 8, he said, "Who are these?" Now this is a ceremony. This isn't like he didn't have any idea who they were. This is a ceremony. It's not, "Let's go see Grandpa this afternoon, and then we can go to a football game." No, it wasn't like that. No, "We're going to go visit your grandfather, and he will bless you. And this will be a prophecy blessing. This is not, you know, 'Bless you, my son. Be a good boy, you know. Blow your nose, whatever else. Comb your hair, too, and wash behind your ears." It wasn't like that. This was a ceremony where the patriarch was pronouncing a prophetic blessing upon his grandsons. And we say, "Well, that's pretty audacious, isn't it? What does he think he is?" Well, he knows who he is. He's God's servant. He knows as much as we know we're in the true church of God. He knew that he was God's servant, did Jacob. And Joseph knew it too. So when he says, "Who are these?" the ceremony is beginning. And Joseph said to his father, "They are my sons whom God has given me in this place." And he said, "Please bring them to me and I will bless them." So here's the blessing, and it's a prophetic blessing. Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age so that he could not see. So Joseph brought them near to him and he kissed them and embraced them. That's also part of, you know, the pomp and circumstance, the ceremony there. And Israel said to Joseph, and this is a sort of a personal comment that was added into the middle of the formality, "I had not thought to see your face, but in fact, God has shown me your offspring." So Joseph brought them from beside his knees, and he was down on his knees too, and he brought them forward with his right hand toward Israel's left hand, Ephraim in his right hand, pushing him forward to Israel's left hand, because when you're facing somebody, your hands are alternated that way. Ephraim was the younger of the two. Therefore, he would get the lesser blessing. The elder one, which was Manasseh, he was firstborn of Joseph, would get the greater blessing. And that's what Joseph expected to happen. He brought them Ephraim, and I don't know why he expected that to happen, though, because Joseph got the birthright, not Reuben. And if you back up another generation, it was Jacob who got the birthright and not Esau. And if you go back another generation, it was Isaac who got the birthright, not Ishmael. So there was a pattern here. God was assigning the birthright where he wanted it to be. So it was going to go to Ephraim. Where was I? All right, here we are. He stretched out his right hand. Okay, we were after the good part yet. He brought them forward, and Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near him. And then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand, he crossed them over, in other words, on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, even though he couldn't see well. For Manasseh was the firstborn, and he blessed Joseph. So first he puts his hands on the sons and pronounces an overall tribal blessing through Joseph himself. God, who before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel, and the angel is a reference to the work that Christ did before his human birth. He was the messenger of the covenants. And you can see that referred to, I think it's Malachi 3 and verse 1. The angel, not an angel, this is an angel as in God, being because the word means messenger, who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named on them. They would be labeled as Israelites, even though they were the sons of Joseph. And the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. So there was the overall blessing. And now we come to the dynamics. And Joseph saw that his father had his right hand on the head of Ephraim and his left hand on the head of Manasseh and so on. It displeased him. And he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." But his father refused. And he said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people." Now we're seeing the prophecy of Manasseh. Because he wanted the great blessing to go on the head of Manasseh. And so now Manasseh is the subject of verse 19. And Jacob is saying, "I know, my son, I know. He shall also become a people. He shall also be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." And the British did that. In a certain way, Manasseh in modern times is an extension of the blessing on Ephraim. Because one of the nations that Ephraim became was America, except that then there was a little bit of a separation issue, and America is now on her own. But you've got Canada and New Zealand and Australia, all the British nations, the English part of South Africa. But then you had the multitudes of others who weren't British, but were governed by the British. They were part of the great empire. India, for example, was ruled by England. Little England ruled great big India, and a swath up through the center of Africa from Cairo down to Cape Town at the height. And Canada, and Australia, an entire continent, and a few little islands here and there. That was the British Empire. Vast. It wasn't the inheritance of America. That wasn't what was to be Manasseh's. It was going to be the multitude of peoples, or of nations, was going to be Ephraim. Only England has fulfilled that. So he blessed them that day and said, "But you Israel, will bless, say, my God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh." And in a way, that has been the case. Everybody wants to be, initially we wanted to be like Britain, and now they want to be like America, because America has so much. It's become proverbial, even though what we have is kind of hollow, but it's sort of a proverb of the modern era. So here was the blessing, that Jacob blessed Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim got the greater blessing, but Manasseh got a great blessing, a very good blessing in that regard. And Israel said to Joseph in verse 21, "Behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given you one portion above your brothers. You received the birthright, which I took from the Amorite with my sword and my bow." But I do want to draw your attention to the last statement of verse 20. You know, "May God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh." And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. By making, it was a proverbial statement, a blessing. "May you be like Ephraim and Manasseh," not like Manasseh and Ephraim. In other words, Manasseh got the primary position in that blessing, in that sentence. And Ephraim, or England, received their inheritance before Manasseh did. The United States came into its own much later than Britain. America didn't even become a world player, a major world power, until World War II. World War I, she showed that the potential was there, but it took World War II to vault her ahead of everybody else, including England. England was sliding down, having defended herself during World War II, sliding down to a lower status, but Manasseh was, the United States was just going like a rocket right past them. And so we can see the fulfillment right here in our time. America doesn't know that. They don't know that their underpinning is from the land of Israel and from God himself through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They don't know that. And because they don't know that, they don't know who they are. They don't know what their true heritage is. And so they don't search there for wisdom and guidance. They ignore the Bible. More and more, it's ignored. And yet there is greatness. When you go to Revelation 7, you have a list of all the 12,000 of each of the Israelite tribes. Chapter 7, verse 6 is where you find Manasseh mentioned. 12,000 of Manasseh will be sealed. And then you go further into chapter 21 of Revelation, and you have the blessing of the New Jerusalem coming down from the Father out of heaven, to the new earth. And it has 12 gates for the New Jerusalem. One of the gates is named after each of the tribes of Israel. So Manasseh and Ephraim are noted there as well. So it's a great blessing that is based on their tribal origin. And of course, some would say, well, how do we know that America is Manasseh? Manasseh doesn't sound like America. No, it doesn't. Manasseh had one son. His name was Machir. M-A-C-H-I-R in English letters. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 3, just as a quick example here. Deuteronomy 3. A little bit more about Machir here. Chapter 3, and we want to look at verses 12 to 15. And this land, which we possessed at that time from Aor, which is on the river Arnon, and half the mountains of Gilead and its cities, I give to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the rest of Gilead and all Bashan and the kingdom of Og. These were kingdoms that Moses led the Israelites up to conquer on the east bank of the Jordan River before Joshua was to lead them across the Jordan after Moses died. So this is the last thing that Moses did, the last leadership he provided. I gave to the half-tribe of Manasseh, Gilead, the land of Gilead, essentially. And that would be up by the Sea of Galilee, across on the other side, on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, on the east side of the Jordan, up in that area. And then Reuben and Gad divided the land south until you come down to the area that Moab and Ammon lived in. So this was, here we have the half-tribe of Manasseh being given that. So that was part of their territory. The other part of the Manassite territory in ancient Israel was over next to Ephraim. It was on the main side, the west side of the Jordan River, where the main body of the nation of Israel is even today. But Manasseh's son was named Machir. And Machir ended up inheriting that land of Gilead, and it became called Machir as often as it was called Gilead. The reason it was called Gilead is because Machir only had one son. His name was Gilead. The Machir or Gilead, but you need to think, how did we get America out of any of that? And that's easy. The people of Machir in Hebrew is Ha-Makiri. Ha-Makiri. You think, well, that's interesting. But that isn't America. Well, neither is Amerigo America, is it? But that was the first name of Vespucci. Amerigo Vespucci, somebody said he's Italian. He wasn't Italian, he was actually Jewish. And he was from Venice. At that time, that wasn't part of Italy. Venice was its own country. And a sailing powerhouse, for that matter. And there were map makers there. And Amerigo Vespucci was a map maker. Map makers were very valuable in the ancient world, even more than they are today, because today you just, go to Google Earth and it's done. You don't have to make a map. But in those days, you had to make a map. You had to travel. You had to sail around the coastlines. You had to draw the coastlines. That's what Amerigo did. He sailed with one of the great admirals of the Spanish Empire at that time, because they already found the Indies with Columbus, and they found South America. Ultimately, he was sailing up the side of the East Coast, and somehow America got labeled America, and everybody says it was Amerigo Vespucci. If it was, Amerigo Vespucci, you must understand, was named after a great Jewish hero from about 500 years earlier, in the 800s. He was in the 1500s, and it was in the 800s A.D., back at the time of just before Charlemagne. Charlemagne's father, in fact, had been driving the Moors out of France down into Spain, and they had one stronghold at the edge of the Pyrenees on the Mediterranean Sea called Narbonne. And the people in Narbonne included a lot of Jews. So Pepin communicated with the Jews, "I'll pay you lots and lots of money if you just open a gate. And we'll come in and end this siege and get these Moors out of here." They didn't mix well with the Moors, you see. And the Jews said, "How much did you say?" And he told them, he said, "That's not enough. We'll all be killed. That's what'll happen." And he said, "Okay, let me think." And he came back with another offer later, and he said, "All right, how about this? They all like to do deals, you know. I'll give you your own Jewish kingdom. Narbonne will be your capital. And you can have your own Jewish king and be a part of our empire if you open the gate." And the gate swung open. Having their own country, now that's something. And won their own king. So they sent back to Babylon in the Middle East for a king. And his name, the one that they got, was what they called the Exilarch. He was the nominal king of the Jews in exile, and a very brilliant young man. He was in his mid-20s when they got him. I forget what his actual name was there. It was about four or five different famous names out of the Bible. But when he came to Narbonne, he assumed or took a throne name, which is typical of kings and queens. They take a throne name. Maybe their name is, Archibald, but nobody wants to be called King Archibald, so they decide to be called King Leo, the lion, so that's a more noble king name. He chose Machir. He became King Machir of Narbonne, or as Septimania. There were two or three different names for the territory, depending on which language you're using. Amerigo was named after him because he enabled and helped the Franks to drive the Moors all out of France, and even ultimately out of Spain. He was a very effective king, and they were a very powerful kingdom. He had lots of connections throughout Europe as far as that goes. Amerigo was named after that hero. So Amerigo is named after Machir. That's right. Amerigo is Machir in Italian. America is Machir in whatever it is we speak here. The bottom line, America has the connection directly back to Israel, and then the country's unaware of that. Our final point, we'll cover much more quickly, is simply this. America needs the truth of her prophetic future. In God's kingdom, that's the positive future. Otherwise, there's a really negative future. They need to be aware of that, too. They need the truth. And there are many denouncements for the kind of behaviors and kind of conduct that America is doing right now. But America was chosen by God to do a great work in this age. I think we need to know that. And when America formed, she found that she needed a constitution that was better than what they started with. 1887, they had a constitutional convention. By 1889, they got it all passed, ratified by the states. But when Thomas Jefferson, who at the time it was all being done, was over in England, or not England, in France as the ambassador, he came back and he and several others realized, we don't have the safeguards that we had so desperately wanted when we were in the Revolution. So he wrote up the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights contained four things that were really important: freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, so you could publicize what you believed, and then freedom of assembly, so you could meet. See, Sabbath keepers weren't accepted in Britain. They had a much more open opportunity than God's church did in America. It was that form of government and that particular assessment of the, or rather, amendment to the Constitution that has enabled America ultimately in the 19th and 20th centuries, especially the 20th century, to be such a powerhouse or a springboard for the publishing and preaching of the gospel of the kingdom of God. America doesn't know that. They've lost vital truths. They don't know their prophetic future. They don't know that the kingdom of God is coming. But they do need to know at least what's in 2 Chronicles 7. This is where we'll close. 2 Chronicles 7. They don't know that God exists. They don't want to think about it. They don't want to think about God's law. They don't want to think about anything that has to do with God, but they need to. America desperately needs these four truths. Here's the opportunity that God gave Israel, and America being a part of that would certainly apply there, and in principle it would apply to any nation. Verse 14 of 2 Chronicles 7. If my people, this is through Solomon, he gives this, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves. Now that would be something. That would be marvelous if America wanted to do that. We don't see the inkling of it at this juncture, do we? If they would humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and I will heal their land. This is unlikely to happen until after Christ returns. But the offer is there, and America needs that truth.